Today, he runs an agency doing $25 million in ARR with around 150 employees. But as the story usually goes, this success didn't come overnight, and it actually started with much more humble beginnings. From not getting paid by one of his first clients to gaining traction with small monthly retainers on Fiverr to now running a successful performance marketing agency for SaaS companies, Garrett Mergoot, CEO of Directive, has learned a forecasting model that's allowed him to scale his agency well beyond those humble beginnings. In today's conversation, he shares the two-part financial forecasting model you need in order to grow your agency, the common mistake agency owners make regarding executive pay, and how to set goals that are meaningful but still attainable for your team. To hear more about those early days as a would-be agency founder, let's start as Garrett shares when an injury dashed his hopes of becoming a pro soccer player.
So I was trying to play pro soccer. That's what I wanted to do. I also didn't want to be that delusional athlete who's like 25 and still thinks they're going to make it. You got to sometimes look in the mirror and recognize you're not good enough. I don't know if I was ever good enough. Probably wasn't, in all transparency, but I hurt my knee, so that helped, right? So I got my knee injury, and I was like, all right, I guess I'm going to focus on my next thing. If it ain't going to be soccer, I'm like, okay, the odds aren't in my favor. I got to try something different. So I was doing my master's at the time, so I did my degree in 3 years at Azusa Pacific University. My fourth year, I was captain of the soccer team. I was trying to go pro. I hurt my knee, and I was doing my master's, and I was working like 5 or 6 jobs, school, odd jobs, independent contractor, things like that. If you've ever done your MBA, a part of it's an internship program. So I wanted to get an internship at a consulting firm. So I applied to the ones I could. And unfortunately, a lot of them have application portals, and Azusa Pacific was not one of their universities that they were including in their list. So I let's just say I didn't get the job, didn't get the interview. I didn't even get the job at Northwestern Mutual. I apparently am a horrible interviewer.
Don't they say anybody can get that Northwestern Mutual job out of college, right?
I couldn't even get that job. I don't know. I am a horrible interviewer. Maybe. I don't know. I'm not
something.
So I was like, you know what? Screw it. I'll just do my own thing. And one day they'll have to acquire me or wish they hired me. And so being the genius I am, I started on Fiverr. So I was selling $5 social media calendars. Just trying to honestly figure it out. Like, I enjoyed solving problems. I wanted to be a consultant. I figured I'm always a very simple-minded person, so I was just young. I figured old people had money. They didn't know how the internet worked. I also didn't, by the way. Like, I didn't have social media, really. I didn't have an iPhone until, like, junior year of college. Like, mm-hmm. You know, we were still coming up pre a lot of this stuff. So I just kind of went and went on Fiverr and started selling social media calendars and market research. I got a library card. And the library card got me access to SIC codes. And I could export industry data and sell it to people for free. And I was like, this is great. So I got myself to like $1,000 a month on Fiverr. I'll bet my buddy I could do it working 1 hour a day. I can make $1,000 a month on Fiverr. So did a whole little thing, had fun with it. I was like, oh, this is kind of fun. People will like trust me and pay me to do digital marketing. So then I went on GoDaddy and I was just trying to find whatever I could find that was like a URL, and I found this Directive Consulting. I was like, I'm a very direct person. This will be great. So bought the URL, called my mom and had her help me make a flyer and print it for me because I didn't have enough money. I kind of been on my own since I was 18, frankly. Yeah. So I didn't have any of that. I never got a loan from no one, never got money from no one, never got money from my parents. But I called my mom. She helped me print the flyers, and I drove around Azusa, California, and handed out flyers to all local businesses. And then the places I went for lunch, I would bring like the flyer with me. I'd be like, hey, I can help you with your Yelp, your Facebook. You don't have a website, you know? So I got the Schwarmer Shop. It's 2013. And built them a Facebook, print out flyers. I took them to the 24-Hour Fitness. I put them on cars for him. I built like just his Yelp. I was just trying my best to, I didn't know what I was doing. I was just watching YouTube videos, trying to teach myself. And came back to get my check on the 30th day. He said, come back tomorrow. So I came back tomorrow. The whole place was boarded up. Dude was gone. Restaurant was gone. And so that is my very first ever client at Directive. I got stiffed on the bill. I'm going to go off camera. So don't hate me for this. But I still have the contract. So it's 7/26/13. I was so stupid. I didn't add the price. So I actually don't even know what I got stiffed with. I just downloaded this off the internet. I didn't know what I was doing. And so did that. And then from there, I was pretty bummed. But like a month or a couple weeks later, my brother was at a hookah shop. He's like, this hookah guy needs help. So I built the hookah guy a website. And then he asked me to rank. He's like, could you rank me number one for hookah in Glendora?
That's where you started down the SEO path, huh?
Yeah.
In a hookah shop.
I was like, I've never done it before, man, but I could probably figure it out. And then I just read every blog post, honestly, I think that Moz had ever written, and watched all the Whiteboard Fridays. And I came up with a motto for myself. Learn, engage, create. So my whole mantra was, if I could learn something new every day, engage with it. So apply what I learned. So take the blog post I read and apply it, like actually execute the knowledge, then I create more value for myself and for my customers. And I've just been trying to do that ever since.
Man, that is so hilarious. I appreciate you, even though, you know, walking off camera, for folks that are just listening to this, you got to check out this episode on YouTube so you can see Garrett pull the contract from the frame. You know, pro tip for you agency founders out there. If you don't have prices on your contract, that's our number one lesson today from 21-year-old Garrett. Whatever the case might be. But I love that you hung on to that. I love that you framed it. I mean, we're going to get into, I've seen some of the stuff you've been doing around your agency academy for other agency owners, talking about financial modeling and other things that they need to learn. I guess this is also like, well, it goes way back to being stiffed and having a forecast, you know, so to speak. I'm doing air quotes for folks just listening of, I'm going to get paid X. And then they stiffed you. We're going to go a little bit deeper than that because you have some really great stuff. But to set the stage for some of that and how that has helped you guys spin up new business units that have eclipsed 1 million in ARR in just a couple of months, I want to get to that as well. But tell us a little bit about how your economics background and your role in doing the books, serving as this CFO for many years within the agency, has kind of changed your thinking as an agency founder and some of the things that that has helped you apply to the agency that has helped you go from getting stiffed from your very first client to now, you know, 20 million plus in ARR.
Yeah, no. Well, you know, honestly, I think the biggest thing is just the mentality as an agency owner. You know, I had a coach once in soccer who said, be good at everything and great at one thing. And I took that really serious because I think that there's a lot of performance that we do where as executives, we kind of insult the craft sometimes. Like we think solutions are so much easier than they are that we can solve things with an email or a Slack message or with minimal effort that we can drive significant revenue or change in our organizations, whether it's to our revenue, to our cost of goods sold, to really our forecast, right? When it comes back to influencing a forecast, what I found was if I wanted to win at this game, be the best agency owner I could be, take as much market share as I could, build something as large as possible for what my talents and abilities are, then I just have to make sure that my personal development outpaces my ambition, right? And so as long as I'm driven to get better at every aspect of this, how do you recruit? What does a recruiting function in an agency look like? What does a finance function in an agency look like? And a lot of people are okay, and I'm not saying this is the right or wrong, both hiring a recruiter, trusting the recruiter, and just not ever buying 20 books on recruiting and trying to have as many phone calls on recruiting and read everything you can and learn everything you can about recruiting. That's always been my mentality, is if I get passionate about something, I try to consume as much information as humanly possible to improve myself in that area, especially if I think that area is going to have economic value to my family or to myself in the coming years. So with that mentality, which I think is the most important part, is just the mentality of the agency owner. They want to be great at their craft and not just link building or SEO or paid media, but great at the craft of running an agency. Then you have to really pursue knowledge. You have to be passionate about learning and engaging with that information and creating more value for yourself and for your clients. And so parlaying that into finance and especially into like a forecast, I think what's really important for agencies is to understand that a forecast doesn't have to limit you. So when I first got started, I thought a forecast would limit because you have to talk about, well, what have you done in the past? I'm like, well, I'm pissed at what I did in the past. I'm very competitive. I don't want to be anchored to the past because the past is not good enough. I'm unsatisfied with the past. So I don't want my future to be a reflection of my past. So I just thought the word forecast was icky because it almost had this sense of complacency, this sense of like, the past will be the future. And look at our forecast. We're going to grow 20% this year. It's like, I don't want to grow 20% this year. I'm pissed that that's what I did last year. I want to fix that. Right. And so I realized you could have two forecasts. You could have one that we could call a growth forecast that you could set your goals towards. This is what you want to accomplish. And if we accomplish these goals, here's how it affects all the other parts of the business. Because forecasts are important, right? It's important that you understand how you're going to staff future engagements that you're forecasting, so that you're able to maintain those engagements with high service level quality and deliverable quality and outcomes for your clients. But you also do need to grow. So it kind of creates this conundrum. And so what I did is I started running the agency on a growth forecast. So that was a forecast that I would say is, okay, what's reasonable? I did 10 demos last month. I'd like to do 15 this month. Okay, so the growth forecast is going to be 15 demos. Now, privately, with my finance and accounting and executives, we have a baseline forecast that says we did 10 demos. I think we probably get to 11 or 12 based off historical month-to-month averages. And if we got to those, would we hire? Would we need to fire? Would we need to downsize, increase our size? And that became a kind of our source of truth, but it wasn't what we based our goals on. And that allowed me to rationalize this concept of anchoring my future performance to my past performance while also being dissatisfied with what had happened in the past. If that makes any sense.
I love that you called the forecast icky, and not for the same reason a lot of agency owners might say is like, oh, I just get bored to tears with finance topics and those sorts of things. But it's, I think I've heard you say this before, like one of the big keys to your success has always been a bit discontent with the past, a little bit dissatisfied, right? And I hear you saying that here as well. And I like this idea of a growth forecast and a baseline forecast, because the other thing with some agency owners is they're so darn optimistic. Otherwise, they wouldn't go down this path, right? If you're listening to this, you have a bit of optimism of we can do this. And you can kind of shoot yourself in the foot by saying, hey, here's the growth forecast, right? Without having that baseline that's kind of based in reality and some historicals. And so what I like about this is it gives that agency owner room to play with and a kind of a safety net while pushing themselves and their team to something without saying, hey guys, if we don't hit this, we're going to have to lay half the people off for something, you know, terrible like that, right?
Yeah, the baseline, right? If you miss the baseline, you're going to have cash absorption. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to essentially not have the bookings and revenue needed to support your headcount and your cost of goods sold. And then conversely, if you exceed the forecast, you'll have account attrition because you won't have the labor required to properly serve, and you'll have employee attrition because you're going to burn them out. And so you have to really understand it all. What we did over the years to maintain gross margin, I'm a huge proponent of gross margin. I think the biggest mistake agency owners make is that they focus on EBITDA before they understand how EBITDA works.
Okay. Tell me what you mean by that.
Yeah. You're not going to have more than 40% EBITDA. Okay. So just full stop. No one has more than 40% EBITDA. In the agency game, there's a couple opportunities to exit and make life-changing money. And I don't think all agency owners know it. And I found that when I coach agency owners, they're very surprised sometimes how this game works. So there's a magic number called $5 million in EBITDA. At $5 million in EBITDA, as an agency owner, you can become a platform company. That means you sell to private equity. They ask you to roll over 40% back into their investment, and they're going to pay you 60%. You're then able to take 60% of that. And at $5 million, you'll trade anywhere between 8 and even all the way up to 15X. Most likely you'll trade at 10 to 12X. So you will make $50 million to $75 million, give or take, on $5 million EBITDA. You'll then get 60% of that. You'll roll 40% back into the private equity group because their goal is to sell you in 3 to 5 years to another private equity group. What a lot of people don't realize is that's actually the game. That is the best way to have an outsized exit in this game. There's no VC, there's no angel, there's no series A. That is this game. Now, if you don't get to $5 million in EBITDA, you get acquired by the platform company. So you get acquired by the person that had $5 million in EBITDA or by what's called a strategic, a holdco, a publicly traded, a Dentsu Aegis, an Omnicom, one of those, S4, et cetera. So my point being is those are kind of your two options. You sell to another agency or you sell to a private equity group. Well, a lot of people focus on EBITDA, but it creates the wrong behavior if you focus on it too early, because EBITDA is a function of total available top line revenue. And if the maximum capacity is 40%, then you can't get to $5 million EBITDA if you don't have enough top line revenue. Now, here's why it's a problem, is if the owners pay themselves off EBITDA, if the owners focus on EBITDA too early, the partners, then they are always too afraid to reinvest their own personal capital back into the organization and grow. So one of the tricks to directive is my partner and I have actually paid ourselves a percent of top line revenue for 10 years straight. Because more money, more problems could not be truer in the agency game. And there's usually two partners. There's an operational partner and there's a new business partner. Well, if the operational partner and you're growing the agency by reinvesting all the EBITDA back into advertising, sales, marketing, growth, product launches, service expansion, et cetera, they're always working, but they're not making any money because they can't. So what they do is they stop investing in the agency because they need to pay themselves off the EBITDA. And then they never get enough top line revenue to ever get an outsized exit. So it's actually the biggest problem in why agencies don't grow today is they pay themselves off EBITDA before they ever had enough top line revenue to have enough EBITDA to have an actual strong exit. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I think you've teed up the problem really well. And you're saying they focus on it too early. So instead of doing that, if folks listening to this say, you know, they're one of the two partners, because often that co-founder relationship is there as you've laid it out, what's your advice for them to get out of that? Man, it just sounds like a hamster wheel, right? Like I got to pay myself. I can't reinvest back into the business. Now I can't grow the business because I'm not investing back in enough. What is the path to step off of that and go towards the path of those two, you know, great outcomes that you talked about a few minutes ago?
Deep discipline and delayed gratification. I think that my partner and I have taken two bonuses in 10 years. If we want to make more money, we sure as hell better earn it. We need to grow the business. No cheating. No tricks. Just because we own the business and we don't have any outside investors and we bootstrapped it doesn't mean that it's a piggy bank to pay for our lives. It's an organization. It's a deep organization that has a responsibility to pay for other people's lives, not our own. If we want to make more money, we need to grow the agency. So that's first and foremost. But to get practical, I'd say 15 million. So I ran directive on essentially less than 5% EBITDA for as long as I can remember until essentially we got to around $20 million in revenue. And then we kind of started to focus more on how we're going to get to EBITDA. Now, the key is while you're growing is you keep your cost of goods sold constant. So what I really focus on is a gross margin of the floor 50 and at the ceiling 60, give or take. And what you're looking at is you want around a 96% monthly recurring revenue retention rate. Okay, so 96% MRR is what the money folks in the industry are looking for when they say, what's a great agency? And they ideally have net revenue retention of over 100%. So that means that your business, very simply put, and I got to hear this and I'll give full credit. This came from Grayson, chairman of Power Digital, most successful privately held agency I think to ever exist. And at least in recent memory, he said his number one piece of advice, and I'm paraphrasing, so apologies, Grayson, is that you need your churn, right? So you need to offset whatever you churn in recurring revenue with growth from your existing portfolio every month. And then anything you drive from new business goes straight to profit. What a brilliant way to focus on EBITDA. Brilliant. And he's amazing at you, far better than I am. I'm pretty decent at top line revenue, but that's what I've been focused on, right? I'm learning how to have EBITDA. I'm learning how to drive margin while still growing the top line of the business aggressively. And what I would say is I think that's a really healthy approach, is get that 96% monthly recurring revenue. And then you want net revenue retention of greater than 100%, which means whatever you lose in recurring revenue, you're able to gain in that same period of time from your existing clients through cross-selling and upselling. And I think that's a really healthy way to look at it.
Yeah. And a very simplified way to look at it. So much in agency life can just feel overwhelming and complex. You know, we're dealing with people both internally and externally. It's not just a product to ship. There's all those nuances and there's all those complexities. And it can feel like, you know, death by a thousand cuts at times. And so we just need some simplicity. And I think that advice that you just shared from Grayson delivers that. As we get back to the two forecasts, Garrett, I'd love to talk through some of the mechanics of how you go about building those two that we talked about, the growth forecast and the baseline forecast. What are, and maybe it ties into these key metrics that you're talking about now in both retention and monthly recurring revenue. Where would someone start to begin the path of, hey, I want to take this advice and I want to start building these two forecasts so I have some simplicity and peace of mind. How could they get started? What are the building blocks to start with this two forecast model?
Yeah, well, for $2,300, they can buy the forecast from my financial module on GarrettMerrigood.com. So my course, I give out all the assets I used during Directive. So you would get the actual agency infrastructure of a $20 million plus agency. And it has modules across HR, people ops, essentially, finance and accounting, sales, marketing, and operations. And these are the assets that drive the business forward. So a financial model might have like 17 tabs, Logan. It's a pretty intense asset. Mm-hmm. But what's key about a good model, if we just talk a little bit more theory on it, is it needs to be a bottom-up build.
Okay.
So you need to take your life cycle stage performance from your sales pipeline and then be able to roll that into an overall forecast. And then each of your service lines you offer should theoretically have its own profit and loss statement that roll up into a unified P&L for the agency. So what I mean by that is you look at new business for, let's say, the SEO department. How many proposals did we get this month? And I'll usually try to focus on proposals held. I think it's the best KPI for understanding the future of an agency. There's very little variance between average order value and close rates once something is got into a pitch that the client has delivered and received. Usually your historicals are fairly consistent, so it's a good leading indicator to build the bookings forecast off of, right? So you bottom up build on the bookings by service line. So I think I'm going to have X amount of SEO proposals, Y amount of paid media proposals, Z amount of creative proposals, right? And I think that those each have the following average order value and the following close rate based on our historicals, which are going to drive the following amount in bookings, which translates to the following amount in monthly revenue. And then you take that, and then that's your bottom-up build on bookings. And then you do the same thing with the headcount by department, right? And everything goes in individual P&Ls that then rolls up into an overall P&L that you're able to essentially run the agency on. So I think the key is really just breaking out the service line P&Ls. If you ever sell to private equity, it'll be the first thing they do with your finances. They're going to start to splice your business. They're going to look at what your margins are for your smaller accounts versus your larger accounts. They're going to look at how your margins are by industry. They're going to look at how your margins are by service line. And then they're going to show you, hey, this is where your business is most profitable because they care about EBITDA. And they're going to have you optimize new business acquisition into the areas where you're driving the most EBITDA. That will be their playbook for you. So the faster you align yourself with that, the faster you become a high quality investment for them.
Hey there, Logan with teamwork.com here with a quick timeout from today's conversation to talk about something that's always top of mind for agency leaders like you, profitability. We understand that profitability is constantly on your mind, but there's one critical part of most agencies' profitability equation that's often misinterpreted, misunderstood, or overlooked completely. Can you guess what it is? Okay, I won't make you really guess. It's billable utilization. If you don't feel like you and your team have a grasp on this key part of agency life, you can change that with a new ebook on agency billable utilization. In it, you'll learn how to define and measure billable utilization and how you stack up against 500 other agencies just like you. Plus, you can get advice from other successful agency owners on how to effectively track and measure billable utilization. You can get your copy at teamwork.com/resources or check the direct link in the description of this episode. All right, let's get back to today's conversation.
And they're going to have you optimize new business acquisition into the areas where you're driving the most EBITDA. That will be their playbook for you. So the faster you align yourself with that, the faster you become a high quality investment for them.
Mm-hmm. So that bottom up build, it really starts with the what we were calling the baseline forecast. And you're basing that on some of the historical data,
yep,
right? And then going up from there to then build your growth forecast, there might be something. I saw you talk about this recently somewhere where we kind of get leading indicators wrong in how we talk about them, how we measure them, especially when we're building a stretch goal or, like we're talking about here, a growth forecast. So talk about that next, that growth forecast, and maybe where we can get the lead measures wrong in trying to build that plan and then try to execute it is the other half of the equation, right?
Yeah, well, I think that that's the bigger part of the equation. I want to talk about that, I think, the most. But when you do a growth forecast, you go through phases as a leader when you set goals, and you see how the goals you have set affect the culture of the agency, right? Nobody likes to be on a losing team. Yet nobody likes to be on a winning team that didn't win anything. In other words, you can't celebrate goals that don't matter, but you can't set goals that no one can hit. It's a bit of a conundrum as an executive.
Right.
Right? Because you can't fake clap. Like, yeah, we're doing better than, well, not better than last year, actually, but we're doing better than we thought. Like, that's not, it's a hard thing to clap for, right? It's like, well, you're still below historical average, but you're doing better. And then the other side is like, we're never going to hit that goal, and it's self-defeating, and team mates quit and they give up because they don't ever think they'll reach the top of the mountain. So you can't have a hill that's so small that nobody is proud of what they've accomplished. You can't have a mountain so big that they die on the way. So the key to the growth forecast is that you are deeply honest with how committed you are personally as the CEO on accomplishing a growth goal. So what I mean by that is, if I know I am not going to invest the time with proximity and passion into hitting a goal I give to someone else. Like this idea that, like, as the CEO, I get to live in my castle. I hire the world's greatest executive team. I send them goals and they just crush them for me is comical.
You check the dashboard and you're like, ooh, it looks good today.
Yeah, I have a saying that rapport building is more important than report building. What you'll find with execs that report into CEOs is that the longer their reports are, the worse their performance is. You know, we have a tendency to try to write away our problems instead of fixing them. And so the reason I'm saying all this is because when you're the CEO and you're the owner of the agency, you have to set growth goals. You have to have a growth forecast. And the key is to understand how it affects your culture and how willing you are to invest in the goals that are stretches. Because if you aren't there with proximity and passion, you probably won't hit it and you'll fail. But this goes kind of that startups business unit that Directive launched really successfully. If you have proximity and passion, then you can set wild goals and knock it out of the park. But if you kind of put a goal in a corner, you put baby in a corner, the goal doesn't get itself magically out of the corner. It stays there underperforming, and eventually you have to solve it. So don't set stretch goals for parts of the business that you have no intention in that time period of personally involving yourself with.
I think that's an interesting segue. You mentioned there, we talked about it at the top of the episode closer to there, about the new division that you guys started up. So you've got a startup division that serves primarily earlier stage companies. You're a couple months in, no churn, crossed $1 million in revenue already for that business unit. Talk to us maybe a little bit about how some of the principles we've been talking about here applied to that and what that looked like in this situation to achieve some of that pretty phenomenal growth and some great directional achievement that we're already seeing there.
Yeah, and the revenue is still doubling. I think it's going to get to $2 million in ARR within 3 to 4 months, which is cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah, again, great customer satisfaction scores. Mm-hmm. Definitely something everybody should be measuring. Customer satisfaction is really healthy because it creates this like a qualitative keep. Yeah, that is quantitative, but it's like a qualitative measurement that you compare next to that 96% MRR. Because you can see like, okay, there could be bad macroeconomic times. Like Directive only serves B2B SaaS companies right now. Well, B2B SaaS is in the dumps. Right? Almost every one of my point of contacts got let go or fired. Almost every one of their budgets got cut by 50%. There's a lot of turmoil. There's a lot of transition. It's a very difficult time in that industry. The industry will be fine. It runs on greed and debt. Ain't going anywhere. Okay. And there's amazing products that are coming out that are going to be very successful. And there's going to be wealthy people and funds that want to invest in those products. We're just going through a natural cycle that every industry goes through. Now, I've tried to go up market for 10 years straight. When you start on Fiverr, crazy to go to market because you start factoring things
up. From those humble beginnings with that contract you got stiffed on with no price on it that we talked about it.
We were $400 a month for a while. We were $4,000 a month, $2,000, $3,000 a month. You know, we were always proud of our like the value we were creating, and we just tried to earn our prices. You know, the way you earn a price, you get to work with bigger people, bigger organizations who have more leverage to create from your advice. In other words, you can only charge as much as someone else's to create value from your advice. So you have to either have unreal advice. By the way, none of us marketers are actually that good. Okay. When we get bad products, we fail. When we get good products, we succeed. None of us are that special. I do all the marketing for Gong and I look like a god, and I do all the marketing for a company you never heard of and I have a hard time. Doesn't mean you can't figure it out, but it's the kind of how it goes in life. And you get to that sense of maturity if you really want to own and honor this craft of marketing, which is you really only are as good as a consultant as your clients. Okay. You aren't some magical wizard or guru or ninja that can solve your clients' problems, but you can deeply partner, honor, and support them, and then leverage your expertise and your craft to improve their outcomes. But there's limitations. So we always have to try to go get the types of clients that can get the most leverage off your advice, because they have the most price elasticity and you can charge them more because they are able to monetize your advice more. Okay. So I've always tried to do that, right? Earn those bigger engagements where my advice and its impact creates more economic value for my clients so I can raise my prices. Now, when the SaaS industry kind of collapsed a bit, frankly, in the last 12 to 24 months, Silicon Valley Bank in March of 2023 was a kind of a tipping point. We had to lower our rates, but I didn't want to drastically increase capacity because humans can only do good work if they have enough time. Okay. There's no lazy people. There's just people who don't have enough time to do great work. If you're good at having a good culture, good at hiring the right type of people, people do want to work hard. People do want to do great work. And when they get in a culture of hard workers where there's everyone is really committed to their craft and their career and they want to be great, I don't have to worry about hard work objective. I have the hardest working team in the agency world. I wanted to make sure they had enough time to like do the kind of marketing that they're proud of, because that's how you retain clients. That's how you build a reputation. That's how you grow. So what we did is we built a very scoped down offering with month to month terms. Traditionally, directives, 12 month contracts, no out clauses. So we're pretty tough on that. So we built a month to month engagement that took the top tactics and most impactful things each of our service lines provided, built a very detailed training on how to perform each of them, hired high performers and taught them how to be a true T-shaped marketer so that we could keep the consulting model of directive and have one human deliver cross-functional value to a client at that price point. It's proven to be awesome. The industry likes the flexible terms. They like the tight packaging. I had this thing for so many years where I believed that flexible SOWs, flexible quoting, swap tables, points, and kind of dynamic pricing was the best way to go. I will tell you, now that I've gotten better at kind of product marketing in agency world, tight packaging, clear deliverables with really tight decks that decrease psychological friction from your buyer allow you to grow a lot faster and a lot better. And so we have a very tight startup pitch deck. We only do it for B2B SaaS. We've got great case studies and examples of the success. It's a deliverable they need based off of 10 to 12 hours a day of living in the industry. And it resonates. And there is true product market fit on this offering. And that's why it's growing so well. Is it's just, you see the pitch and you're like, oh, sold. When can I start? And if you can get your service that tight, that's the dream.
Yeah. Absolutely. It reminds me of a conversation I think we might both be connected with him, Sam Shepler over at Testimonial Hero. Yeah. He was on the show previously and talking about their journey to really get tight and productize their service within the agency. We'll link to that in the episode description here, along with Garrett's Agency Academy course that he mentioned earlier. What question I have there that is, I mean, it sounds like you guys have found a way to do this, but you guys have always prided yourself on directive of being the consultants, being the experts, being the masters in your craft that you want to continue to be as the agency CEO, and you want that throughout a high-performing team. When I think some people say, well, if we productize and we get it really tight and we get away from this dynamic SOWs and lots of different options, then there's a danger of being kind of commoditized. So what's your advice for folks or your answer to that pushback on how you get really tight and really productized in a certain business unit, or maybe the whole agency, depending on where you're at, but maintain that expert authority that you want to have as the consultant who's a true partner and not just a vendor to your clients.
Yeah, Sam Bello is a great guy. He's also taken the Academy course, just as a note.
There we go. Nice tie-in.
Great guy. Really talented. Building something really awesome. Methodology. So I think what we always, not everybody, but I'd say like 99% of agencies, and myself included for so long, I didn't know it. I mean, I never worked for nobody, so I just kind of have to learn on the go and just try to do my best to figure out what the agencies that are ahead of me have done and really decipher it and understand, okay, well, why did I work for them and how can I apply it to me? And, you know, how do I get the time around? You know, a lot of times it's like calling those CEOs, be like, hey, man, will you mentor me? Like, you've built what I want to get to and I just want to learn. Like, can you coach me? And I've had amazing coaches myself, frankly, over the years that have helped me get from each kind of milestone to the next and really let them into my heart, let them into my emotion, let them into what my vision is and what my struggles are. And I've found a ton of value from hiring coaches that are ahead of where you're trying to get to. But methodology, man, methodology. I have a saying that in the agency game, people will only pay you more for different, not for better. And it's almost impossible to convince someone you're better. And it's exceptionally easy to convince someone you're different. So I always want to be selling oranges if everybody else is selling apples. I don't want to tell you that I've got a better apple than the other guy's apple. I want to tell you that I've got an orange and he's got an apple. And if you like oranges, that's great. I'm just not an apple. That's what people want. And so the key to all of your pricing and your packaging is that it's methodology based. So what our startup package is it's a scoped down version of our customer generation methodology. It's not a random thing. It's all unified into how we believe that B2B SaaS organizations should grow from performance marketing. We have real beliefs on what it means to advertise on LinkedIn. We never want to use LinkedIn's data. We only want to use manually verified data that we get from your customers that we then enrich, understand, model out, and then find other companies that match your exact ICP. But we have really strong opinions. If you don't want our opinions, that's fine. Hire an in-house team. But we got to remember why we exist as agencies. We exist for our methodology, our differentiation, our opinions, and our insights that we get from servicing multiple people in a certain industry. That's how you derive expertise. So we have to make sure that we are able to articulate our expertise in the form of a methodology and then package that methodology into viable services. And if you're able to do that, your agency is able to grow pretty quickly.
I think that is fantastic advice. We've actually discussed something very similar on this show. And so if you're hearing what Garrett is saying, two other episodes, especially if you are new to the show, we've got a lot of new listeners and viewers of the podcast. If you missed Three Steps to Owning Your Niche in 90 Days with Nick Bennett from Harness and Hone, or Five Steps to Win More Clients Using Benchmark Data with Chris Nault. We'll put both of those in the episode description because both of those two episodes, you know, Nick talked about the niche that you solve a problem for that you deeply understand from a first party hand-to-hand combat sort of way. And that's how you can niche down and you can create, this is our methodology to solve this problem, but it has to start with a specific problem for a specific type of company or someone who's experiencing that. It doesn't always necessarily by industry. You guys have done it really well with B2B SaaS. And then Chris Nault echoed something that you were just talking about there, Garrett, in when clients are saying, well, what kind of results can I expect? Not just case study, but hey, we understand this works, this doesn't. We understand that of these 50 clients, here's kind of the average. And using that benchmark data that you can speak to with confidence and not just saying, well, LinkedIn's latest report says this or that, because that doesn't instill any sort of confidence. I think those are two great follow-ups to the advice that you're giving here to get tight, to productize those services, but not commoditize yourself. So great advice. I think it's time for us to transition into our fast five and our good shout as we round out the conversation today. Garrett, you ready for our rapid fire round, our fast five here on Agency Life?
Let's do it.
All right, man. Number one, if I think you've created some content around this, if you had an extra $10,000 a month, so 100, 120K a year to invest in the agency, where do you think you would put that and why?
Probably save it right now. So what I'm focused on, but if I wasn't doing what I'm doing, I'm usually like, I hired a product guy at one point, and I thought it was one of the best hires I ever made. He actually does positioning now. His name's Laurent Matson. He's a consultant He worked with me for multiple years. Very, very talented at positioning and productizing your services. I'd check him out and I would definitely hire him if you want to build your own methodology.
Yeah.
His name's Laurent Mattson.
Okay.
Great guy. And I would hire someone like him and really build out your wikis. So really get strong at your documentation. What I found is I built an amazing methodology that I sold very well and not all my employees knew how to deliver.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's pretty hard. If your methodology is truly different, you can't hire people that know how to do it because it's different. So you have to get really good at productizing the training and the organization, your onboarding and your learning and development function as an agency, because we're talent businesses.
Yeah.
So if you really do niche down, you're going to have a hard time hiring people that have enough experience in your niche. So you're going to have to teach them the niche. And if you niche down even more to a methodology for that niche, you're going to have to train him even more on why what you do is different than everybody else for that niche. And so if I had $10,000, I'd really focus on the fulfillment and training and productization of my notion, of my onboarding materials and everything else.
Yeah, that's a really good call out. If you're getting really tight with your service offering, not only does that change the way you market it, but it changes the way you document and train your team on delivering it. All right, Garrett, this might be tough for you because I know you're a voracious reader, but what are some of your top all-time business books that are your favorites, especially those that you're recommending to other agency owners specifically?
I mean, there's so many good ones that have all, like, everyone has a good, like, you can gain something from. So Good to Great is always a great. The Winning by Design books, I found agency owners are very poor at sales process and they don't understand its value or its importance, or they might have this icky feeling towards free work directive. I always want to do more free work than anyone else. So if we are in a pitch together, me and you, if you're listening to this, make sure I don't outwork you because I'm going to do everything in my power to earn that business and show as much value free as charge to win that account. And so I would say Winning by Design. I'd say Good to Great. I would say Who. Another thing agencies are very poor at is a strong interview and recruiting process of how they top grade and onboard new individuals as a talent business. It's a critical function. So Who is an amazing book that you can read and directly apply. And then, yeah, I'd say those three. Those are probably the three most applicably strong books I've seen.
I love it. Good and rounded out there. All right. Number three, Garrett, what's one mistake you've made in running your agency that you'll never forget?
I mean, I make so many mistakes and I've tried to forget them all. just because, you know.
Was that saying? That was a Ted Lasso, right? Be a goldfish. Forget about those mistakes pretty quickly.
Oh man. No, I would say a pretty big mistake that I learned was that very first one, which was, you know, you can't do it. Like we work with Snapchat, Uber, AWS, a lot of those Allstate. I don't get to like do this with them, but get paid before your kickoff call. So, you know, cash is king in the agency game. Most of us are bootstrapped or have minimal funding. You know, there's not like much angel investors or VC for us. And debt's really hard to procure because we don't have any tangible assets. So we are in a very cash heavy environment. And if you go back to my advice on that 5% EBITDA, I did that after I had 3 months runway. So once I built 3 months runway in cash, then I just put it into 5% EBITDA. Then I barely paid any taxes. And I just reinvest everything into sales and marketing to grow top line revenue. Mm-hmm. Side note.
Yeah.
But I think that's a healthy insight because it goes to this point of like, with the cash, it's just you gotta focus there and just build it.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of agency consultants and a lot of agency owners, both current and past on this show, talk about the fact that you shouldn't be the bank for your publicly funded or, you know, investment heavy clients who have the cash and you don't, right? Cash is king. So don't set yourself up to be your client's bank. I think Drew McClellan from AMI said that in one of our previous webinars. All right, number four and five to round it out, Garrett, two sides of the same coin. Number four, what do you think is the hardest part about agency life? And then number five, what do you think is the best part to end our fast five on a high note?
I think one of the hardest parts about agency life, it's not just for the owner, I think it's for everyone, is clients manage us with a sense of deep dissatisfaction.
What do you mean by that?
And so I think for a lot of people, when they start the agency game, they can connect their own opinion of their success and their value to what their clients say about them. And so I'd say that's one of the hardest parts, especially as like a consultant for your teammates, for your employees, for the people who are really on the front lines for you, working with those clients every day. is you can crush it for somebody, be up 200% to goal, and they'll be like, oh, that's amazing. What's next? Because they manage us with a whip. Now, I do think the best point of contacts have a whip, but they have a nice, firm hug too, if that makes sense. And I think that's always the best in leadership. I'm still trying to develop those same empathetic skills alongside the drive and competitive spirit that can foster both. And that's something I'm trying to personally grow in. But I would say that probably is one of the hardest parts, is that a lot of times you get into the agency game, at least hopefully, because you love helping people and you like to have an impact on their lives. Like, I know that's where my biggest passion, and that's the good part of the agency, is when I see someone like Laurent Mattson have success in this positioning, when you get to see someone leave your organization and go get their dream job. Because right now, everybody's going to be at your agency forever, right? And so how can you be a stepping stone and celebrate your alumni? And when people go in-house or if they go to another agency, and the impact you can have on the industry and the craft of marketing and on those people's lives. So I'd say the most fun part is the fact that in a people business, like an agency, is you get to do life and relationship with your people and be a part of their professional journey. Even if you have to let them go, something happens, there is a way to still honor, love, and support everyone you work with and build a community of people that are having an impact in the marketing world, in their personal life, and in their professional world.
Absolutely. I've seen, just kind of looking at the directive story, a lot of folks that have been with you a long time, some folks that were with you for a long time and have launched into other things, that still there's a great relationship there from what I can see and some of the people I know who have been on your team. So I love the way that you guys are doing that. And I do think it's one of the best parts about agency life. All right, to wrap things up, Garrett, we want to give you the chance to give someone a shout out who's impacted your journey in agency life. Could be personal, could be someone you've worked with, family, or someone who's kind of mentored you from afar digitally or something like that. Who do you want to give a shout out to today?
I would give a shout out to Grayson because he's been helpful in my life. But Andreas Roll was a coach I had. We were at about $6 million and he really taught me how to run a bigger agency. So shout out, Andreas. Appreciate it.
Awesome. All right, Garrett, for anybody listening to this who's interested in maybe your Agency Academy course or connecting with you, following along with some of your content, what's the best way for them to reach out, find more, and stay connected?
Yeah, I've got GarrettMaker.com, my website. We filled the form. I don't get that many form fills, so I'll get back to you right away.
And I love the honesty.
Yeah, I'm not very popular, so I always try to respond to everybody right away. You can shoot me an email, first initial, last name. You can connect with me on LinkedIn, Twitter. I try to get back to everybody right away and help in any way I can. So yeah, feel free to connect.
Awesome. Well, link there into your LinkedIn, obviously, and that Agency Academy course. I've seen some of your breakdown, kind of the quick 5 to 6 minute videos you've got on your YouTube page. What prompted me to want to talk about the forecasting today, and some really great stuff. And I appreciate you being our guest today on Agency Life. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you, Logan, man. It's great being here. And if you're a SaaS company and need help with marketing, check out Directive. But yeah, thanks so much for having me, Logan. This is great.
You've been listening to Agency Life. And if you made it this far, you're probably enjoying the show. If so, you can help other agency leaders find the show in about 14 more seconds. If you're listening in Apple Podcasts, you can simply scroll down till you see ratings and reviews and tap the number of stars you think the show deserves. We'll really appreciate it, and so will the other agency leaders who find the show based on your rating. And if you're looking for even more content to support your agency life journey, check out teamwork.com/agency life. There you can search through past episodes, get access to the Agency Life newsletter, and find additional video content to support and inspire you as you continue on this crazy roller coaster ride that is agency life.